Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening. Welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. And welcome radio listeners who we invite to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. I am Karen Kiefer, a program coordinator for the club and your chair for this evening. This program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Now and Then series, as well as the club's Good Literature series, which is underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And now it is my pleasure to provide you a little background about tonight's dynamic speaker and friend to all. Janice Mirigatani is a visionary, community activist, leader, poet, editor, and a substantive ray of hope and change for many. Janice is the founding president of the Glide Foundation, where she, in partnership with her mutual partner and husband, the Reverend Cecil Williams, have achieved worldwide recognition for their groundbreaking organization, which empowers San Francisco's poor and marginalized communities to make meaningful changes in their lives to break the cycle of poverty and dependence. Over 43 years together, they built 87 comprehensive programs that provide education, recovery support, primary and mental health care, job training, housing, and human services. Janice Mirigatani is also San Francisco's second poet laureate, appointed in 2000. She has authored 4 books of poetry: Awaken the River, Shedding Silence, We the Dangerous, and Love Works. And she's the editor of 9 landmark anthologies, which provide platforms for writers of color, women, youth, and children. Janice has also worked in civil rights causes for various multi-ethnic communities, including the struggle for redress for Japanese Americans incarcerated during World War II, of which she and her family were one. In her spare time, as if she has any, Janice has been serving as a commissioner on the San Francisco Arts Commission since 1996 and was reappointed by Mayor Newsom in 2004. She's the recipient of over 40 awards and honors, including the Governor and First Ladies Conference on Women and Families Minerva Award, San Francisco State University's Distinguished Alumni Award, the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce's Lifetime Achievement Ebby Award, the prestigious American Book Lifetime Achievement Award for Literature, and the University of California at San Francisco Chancellor's Medal of Honor Award. Ms. Mirigatani received 2 honorary doctorate degrees after graduating from UCLA. With this short bio of this incredible woman and friend, we now welcome to the podium to tell her journey of recovery, the very distinguished Janice Mirigatani.
Thank you. Thank you, Karen. Are you sure this isn't Sunday? It's so great to see so many wonderful, familiar faces. And those of you I haven't met, it's great for you to be here tonight, especially with this weather. You know, this was a very difficult, much more difficult than I realized it would be, this engagement. And I think it's because, you know, when you think about talking about yourself, you don't quite know where to start, and you don't quite know what to say. Because, you know, I'm an approval junkie, and I don't like to bore people, and I don't think that, you know, I don't know. I don't know how much is very interesting about my life. But I want to ground myself by starting with a poem, if that's okay. And it's a poem to my mother. Mother, look what has been created out of spools of your life, strands of rope tied to my sleeves, a string of warnings. Men abandon imperfect women, you say. Your hands have crafted embroideries for me of not enoughness. Pretty is not enough, you said. I thought if I was perfect, you would love me. I worked hard to get perfect grades, made perfect stitches, perfect rituals for failure. Smart is not enough, you say. Mother, I have watched you save balls of twine, rolled into infinite lifelines, grandmother, mother, me. You reluctantly reveal your ends of string bound to barbed wire of concentration camps and broken marriages. Being citizen is not enough, you say. You show me knots of humiliation called jab and chink, without teeth and without husband. Marriage vows are not enough, you say. You tell me to be independent of men and weave fibers of rebellion in my bones, with purple threads of abuse woven in my tapestry. Suffer with dignity, you say. The red of your stubbornness, yellow streaks of defiance, and the amber of my voice. I loosen knots and I unravel, cut loose, connect, bind, repair. Look, mother, these hands shaped like yours, this body that holds the strands of you, this spirit rising up. I unravel the tangled threads of unworthy and discover your love, my love. I am ferocious affirmation, the stubborn root of a weed holding fast to soil of imperfections, beautiful enough in all my contradictions. Look, mother, how powerful is this mending. So I was asked to talk about on the theme of then and now, and I have to say that, you know, at Glide, I have the privilege of being in a place where the past hums with the present, and the present offers opportunity for tomorrow, and it gives us a vision of what is possible for tomorrow. And I begin to find the ends of a string of stories and how they like ganglia, you know, the knots, the nerve endings, the place where the neurons strike off and inspire other electricity among neurons and cells. You know, I took a little biology, but and I don't know how this stuff works, but it felt like a good metaphor. Anyway, so, you know, touching off responses and memories and kicking in body reactions like nausea or euphoria. And, you know, to talk about myself in relationship to that, I thought, okay, string, tying ends, knotting, unraveling, seems like a great metaphor. And I'll start with Glide because Glide grounds me. I think Cecil and I have been working all these decades to interconnect the threads and the knots and the ends that have been loose, and we now tie together into a tapestry of a beautiful community. I mean, look at this audience. Beautiful community. Our nerve endings touch and inspire and spark creativity and possibility in others, especially those who have been discarded to the margins of life. The threads tied from the meals program to our walk-in center to emergency needs and the recovery programs, the women's center. The threads tie together these lives with the clinic, the mental health care, the primary health care, the youth. You know, the youth, we have to bind ourselves to these youth. They're in such jeopardy. They are an endangered species, our young people, from the poor communities particularly, who are caught up in violence and who are caught up in lifestyles that are destructive to them. We have to bind ourselves to them and provide those strands of light for them to be able to grasp a hold of. You know, and I think we're connected in so many ways to all the neighborhoods of the Bay Area. We provide education, you know, we've built a family, youth, and child care center. Those strands wrap around the families, wrap around the women, wrap around, you know, the parents who need free child care. They wrap around these ladies and these men with parenting classes, with nutrition classes, with ways in which they can find alternatives in their lives that will be that will provide a better future for their children. I think that we are inextricably bound in this community, and we're bound because of our efforts for recovery. You know, I think that GLIDE is a place where we can experience the ends of each other that provide a way that we can practice radical love. And what I mean by radical love is that it's the kind of love where you don't try to change somebody else. You start by changing yourself. That, to me, is radical love. Because that's how you create the ground of mutuality. That is truly how you enable others to see the possibility for change. Not because you're telling them what they should be doing, but you say to yourself, this is where I should put my life. I should connect myself. How many of you have seen Avatar? Oh, goody. Then we can talk about the tail thing and you'll know what I'm talking about. We should be able to connect each other like that, to say, you know, we are each other's soul force. We can connect and we can understand one another as human beings. We can understand our pain and we can understand our stories, no matter what, how different our experiences might be from each other. So I feel very connected. I feel knotted to all of these programs that Cecil and I have been bringing together for 4 decades in this village. And, you know, we've just finished a third building for affordable housing for homeless people. That's opening up this month. And I don't know, Cecil is such a great deal maker. GLIDE didn't have to spend a penny for these housing projects. Isn't that great? It's done through creative partnerships. You know, when I was coming up in this city and we were going, well, okay, I'm going to get to that. Anyway, so GLIDE is also this place where the threads and the ropes of social justice and spiritual nourishment and service to others and concrete programs are tied together that house and train people to break out of their cycles of dependency. It is a place where radical love truly is practiced so that we can be a liberating force, not a dependency source. So I think that that is really an important point to make, because I will tell you, radical love has saved my life. So, you know, and at GLIDE, we don't separate social justice from spirituality, from the things that we do on a daily basis. And I am so grateful that at GLIDE we don't separate creativity and poetry and dance and art and story from everything that we do. In fact, the basis of our recovery programs are based on story. We have a wonderful group, recovery group, that we call Speak Out. And some of you are here tonight. Yay for Speak Out. If I get stuck, I know I'm not going to have a problem. I call you guys up and you'll tell my story because my story is their story. But it you know, it's a place where I get enormous joy out of hearing the music from Charles and Magnolia's poetry and Angela's poetry and Greg's poetry, and you are all here tonight. And it's just a fabulous way in which we are truly tied together. So You know, I guess you can tell the things that excite me about Glide. And I continue to have that passion. I continue to have it renewed daily. I particularly love to hear the poetry from our children because they're so real, you know, and they don't allow us to escape. So thinking about my own life and how, you know, as a child, as a baby, sent to a concentration camp from California, I was born in Stockton, and my whole family was shipped off by train to Aurora, Arkansas. All of the families that we knew were separated. My grandmother went to Amache Gate. You know, my cousins and my aunts went to Tule Lake. Others went to Manzanar. In fact, every one of our family was at every single one of the 10 camps in this country. We were that segregated. I don't remember much because I was an infant, but I do remember when we relocated and we moved to the East Coast because we heard that racism wasn't as bad on the East Coast. We did not go back to California, where my maternal grandparents returned. But I do remember that my mother lost her teeth. Now, many women in camps lost their teeth. She was nursing me, and there was no nutrition, no food, no dairy, no fresh produce, no protein in the camps. They talk about a constant diet of rutabagas and potatoes. But she lost her teeth, and we had to go to a Japanese dentist because nobody else would see us. And he molested my mother and myself in the dental chair. But we didn't have any choice because nobody else would see us. And I would remember my mother crying and saying, "Why didn't you protect me? Why didn't you come into the room and sit there while that man was working on my teeth?" And I'm going, "Mom, I'm 4. But, you know, of course, teeth were not the only things that we lost. We lost our property, all of the possessions. We took to camp only what we could carry. She lost a husband, divorce. We lost other relatives to suicide, to alcoholism, to, you know, a variety of mental issues that people suffered after the camps. And I will say that people, you know, somebody asked me about it earlier because, you know, it's not unusual for the Japanese Americans not to talk about this experience. In fact, I had to beg my mother for 40 years to tell me what happened in the camps, and she would totally avoid the subject. But I connect that memory of the vulnerability of us being in post-war Chicago and being picked on, you know, by white kids who were bigger than us and being dragged down the icy sidewalks on the way to school and being dragged down the stairs. And I remember being put on a clothesline in a blizzardy day, and I was pulled on that clothesline by these kids and being called a kamikaze plane. And I'll tell you who saved me. Who saved me were these African-American kids who came to my rescue and took me down from that clothesline. But that story, and I'm these strings of story, that story connects to a mark in time 40 years later. You know, we had since moved back to California, but 40 years later, when several generations, my generation, the third generation, particularly fought for redress and fought for the commission hearings. And my mother finally broke her silence of 40 years by testifying before that commission. And the stories, the strings of stories that tied together and that made my history make sense to me is that, you know, she finally told the story of delivering mail in camp. That was her job. And she didn't get paid for it, but that was her job. And she told of having to deliver mail to a family, an Issei, first-generation family, whose 5 sons served in the United States Army as U.S. soldiers, and all 5 had been killed in combat. She had to deliver mail to that family. And there they were, in prison camp, because of our nationality. a new mother whose baby was denied hospital care before they boarded their buses to a camp in Tule Lake. The baby died on the bus, and it took 2 days for people to extricate that dead child from that mother. And, you know, stories about how women who were so humiliated because there were no stalls in the public bathrooms, in the public huge bathrooms, were so humiliated they wore paper bags over their heads so that they could hide their shame. And stories about babies, 10 babies who died stillborn in Tule Lake. These are stories that many people do not know about. These are stories that live in my poetry. These are stories that connect me, I think, to this daily passion that I have for justice. The daily passion that I think I have the privilege, the honor, to be able to fight for in our communities. And I do consider that a privilege. You know, this city is a great city, and I didn't think I'd be doing this, folks. But it's okay, you know, because we say at GLIDE that this is part of our recovery. We'll edit out, and hey, it's just, and no shame. We can't let ourselves get connected to that shame again. But the social justice work truly is a privilege to be able to connect to the LGBTQ community about equality marriage, to be able to continue to fight for human rights and civil rights, no matter what community it is. It is a privilege. It is part of what feeds us. It's part of what gives us, you know, the spark of inspiration to continue to build a community that truly is a magnificent tapestry. And this city offers us that opportunity more than any other city. It is such a jewel. And, you know, I remember those days, Judy, when we were fighting for, you know, women's rights. And I remember the days when we were marching in the streets against bombing in Cambodia, and we were being told that we weren't in Cambodia. I remember the days when we were fighting against the war in Vietnam, and Phyllis, you know, those children who were being airlifted out of Saigon. And I remember all of the days when we were able to be together in a way that affirmed the voices of people of color. Because as a poet, and I was raised on all dead white British guys, you know, poets. That's what I learned in college, that those, you know, that was the model of good literature. And we didn't have our voices reflected anywhere. We didn't have our voices in our language. And, you know, I never knew that Pablo Neruda existed. I mean, what a gift to find you, Toshio Mori and Pablo Neruda and June Jordan and Maya Angelou and so many incredible voices that reflect our history, our culture, our heart, our experiences. Okay, if I'm rambling, raise your hand because, you know, I'm trying to connect the strings. But, you know, when I was in, and I'm trying to tie the strings to each of these issues, like the camp experience and how that connects me to our passion, I think, for social justice, how I can resonate with Cecil's, you know, stories about slavery and about racism and segregation. You know, these strings truly make sense tied together. I remember also when we were in Chicago, my mother had to work two jobs, and she did peace work at night. You know what peace work is, right? Some of you folks who are old enough to know what peace work is. My mother made crepe paper flowers late into the night for 2 cents a flower for the American Legion, which was quite ironic, right? And I had begged for a Sonia Haney doll. Now, again, Sonia Haney was a famous movie star in the 40s, and she was an ice skater, and she was blonde, and she was beautiful, and the way my mother had me taken care of when I was a child is that she would put me into movies as my babysitter. So I'd watch the same movie over and over and over again until she finished work. And, of course, I would see these Sonia Haney movies. And I begged for a Sonia Haney doll. Begged for this doll. And she worked extra flowers to get me this doll. The first thing I did was I cut Sonia Haney's doll hair, her blonde hair, and I pasted it to mine, thinking it would turn me blonde. And that, you know, that story of, and you know, I think we've heard it in various versions. You know, I've seen Whoopi Goldberg's routine about her beautiful straight hair. When we talk about racism in America, I really believe that this is the impact that it has. When we don't see the positive role models of ourselves, when we don't see ourselves reflected in the movies and popular media, what we do is emulate those that we do see. And we internalize, whether we are conscious of it or not, a kind of self-hate and a self-rejection, which I can tell you very honestly I did for many, many, many years. A self-rejection that was fierce. You know, I went as far as scotch taping my eyes so that they would look round. You know, we went through all kinds of tortures. I don't know if any other women of color have done this, you know, torturous stuff, but I can tell you everything to make your skin lighter. I can tell you how to peel your skin, including poison oak. But we would do things to be lighter, to be whiter, to be blonder, to be, you know, to be more acceptable by society. And I don't know if this resonates for anybody else, but I believe that that is how slavery truly is enacted. It is, you know, more than the physical chains. It truly is the chain, the binds of self-hatred, of self-rejection. And I think we see it played out even today in our public school systems, in many ways in which our people, which people are discriminated against. When I was 5 years old, my mother remarried to a man who was very abusive. And his background is that he was a Kibe. A Kibe is a person who is born in America and educated in Japan. He spoke Japanese, and so the army recruited him to translate for him Japanese to English. And they mistreated him terribly. He was married to a woman who was a Caucasian. When he came home for a leave, she was pregnant with another man's child, and she left him. And he was, and again, I think that his bitterness is something that I felt balled up in his fist. He just carried that around. And his bitterness came out also because I looked Japanese, because I was very Asian-looking. My mother was not. But his taunting and his hatred about his own race, I think, was a very graphic way in which that internalized rejection was really, really delivered in a generationally destructive way. I think that, the ridicule and the humiliation of rejection is more damaging than even the physical effects. When I was in high school in Petaluma, California, I remember junior high school, I remember a young African-American. It was an all-white school. There were 10 of us Japanese-Americans. And I remember an African-American young lady came to our school, and she was reviled. She was thrown spitballs at. She was, you know, screamed at. She was told to get out. She was, people threw books, kids threw books at her. And I felt so torn by that situation. And, of course, I was too scared to stand up for her. And finally, a teacher had to accompany her out of the school, and we never saw her again. And I went to the cafeteria that day, and my good friend Roberta, who is this gorgeous redhead, I thought she was my good friend, was laughing and talking to some other people in the cafeteria line, and she said, "I don't know why these people come to this school. Why don't they just, you know, why don't they just stay where they belong? And they're so ugly, and why are, you know, why would they come and try to come into our school?" And I realized from what she was saying She said, but you know what? She does my homework for me, and her mother makes great cream puffs. And I realized she was talking about me. She was not talking about the African-American woman. Anyway, I wrote a poem about Roberta. That's how I get my revenge. I hope somebody sends her the book. I hope somebody tags the poem. Anyway, but I was saying to someone that that moment where I could not stand up and do the right thing with that young woman has lived with me and has stayed with me. I felt ashamed because I did not have the courage to do the right thing, and that stuck with me. But you know that knot that sits in our being, that knot, that place where we go to when we don't feel good about ourselves, that knot that makes me go out of my body is what I realize is the shame place. You know, it's the shame around the abuse, it's the shame around feeling in collusion with the abuse. It's the shame around not doing the right thing and wanting approval so much that I didn't have the courage to affirm my voice and to stand up. And so I think unraveling that knot has been a lifelong journey. It's been part of the recovery. It continues to be a way in which I tie my end to yours, to whatever your shame and whatever your pain is, that it's my way to continue to find ways to lift people up out of that darkness, you know, to offer that strand of light through these programs, through the beautiful community that we have that support each other, through all of you who come to support me tonight. You know, thank you for your tales, for your strands of light, in letting me know that you are with me and that I am connected. And I have to say this about my husband. He's just really the sweetest man. He's really sweet. And sometimes he tries to help me not to experience pain, so he's got all these suggestions for me. And, you know, he says, well, just tell him about how you face the challenge and just get back up and, you know, start fighting again. And I said, okay. Easier said than done. But, you know, he went out and bought me a pot that I could heat up soup and coffee. And, I mean, he's really great. But he is not easy. And, you know, I've got this strand that I wanted to talk to you about, the violence and the abuse and how it perpetuated in my life through college and, you know, through my young adulthood as I got involved with violent relationships and battering and feeling like, you know, that was the expression of love, to be beaten and to somehow be in a possessive, jealous relationship. And I do know that that is how I felt for many years, that that was the way I was being loved. Because my stepfather and the other adult males in my family, those were the moments of tenderness. Those were the moments when, you know, it felt like I was being accepted. And those were the moments of greatest shame. But I think the abuse, the abuse became unacceptable at a point when I began to find my own voice and began to define what I needed for myself. When I was believed by Cecil, when I was believed by the circle of women who are in recovery, when I could hear their stories, when I knew I wasn't alone, again, those ties that bind us together and show us that we are all acceptable, that we are all lovable, and that truly, whether you call it spirit or God or Yahweh or whatever belief system you hold, that there is that presence, that lifts us up and lets us know that we're not alone. I have a ton of poems about violence. I'm really good at describing the specificity of violence. So I'm not going to read any of those tonight because they're not very cheerful. But I think that how we have gotten to the place where we can address the violence. I'm so proud of our women's center at Glide because, you know, women say these things that are phenomenally true. I mean, you don't think about them and they're so real. One woman just said the other day, you know, I was with this man and I knew he wasn't good for me, but I was in jail and I was lonely and he was there. And how true is that for many of us in terms of loneliness and in terms of, gee, do I deserve better? I don't deserve better. So we are, you know, we are for ourselves and each other those strands of light. And we tell each other, you don't deserve that. You deserve much better. I thought I would just end by saying that I didn't know I was lovable until I was loved. And I am blessed to have discovered a person who could love me unconditionally. And he loved me unconditionally before we were even together. And I think he has saved thousands and thousands of lives because of his love and his acceptance. Cecil has truly opened the door for many of us to provide and create our own miracles, if you know what I mean. He and my grandmother are very much related in that unconditional love thing. I think if it weren't for my grandmother way back in Petaluma, I wouldn't be here today. But she is the one who believed in me and provided me that strand of light that was my lifeline. And you know, when I first came to Glide and I was involved in very self-destructive behavior and, you know, drinking too much and into very violent relationships, and I could see the chaos that this man was creating in the church, and it was glorious. It was wonderful because he was out in the streets and he was reaching out to hookers and, you know, drug addicts and poor people and everybody of every description, and they were all coming into this church. And you know, church for me, like for many of you, was this place of real quiet, forbidden exclusion. I mean, you know, only one kind in there. You could see only one kind in there. But, I mean, Glide was a place where everybody was, and I was given the blessed opportunity and the privilege to help and to join, to give service to save my own life. Because I think that that's how we do save our lives, is that we give to others to save our own lives. So I wasn't going to cry and I wasn't going to ramble, but I've done all of that. And I have to say that Cecil, people say, women say to me all the time, gee, you're so lucky to be married to Cecil. And I look at him and I'm saying, you don't know what you're talking about. Luck has very little to do with it, and really, really hard work. And I would say that, you know, love, radical love, if it is worth it, does require enormous, enormous work. And it requires an enormous capacity for humor. It requires an enormous ability to look at yourself and laugh at yourself and to be able to admit to yourself and to the other that you are wrong. And that you're, you know, like messed up and sick, and that you've got these kind of weird, quirky insanities. And, you know, Cecil and my insanity sometimes really do hook up like that tail thing. And we really do understand each other in terms of our chaos, our need for chaos, our need to create. And I was saying to Glide yesterday that, you know, I've just turned 69. This monitor announced it to a bunch of street people, and I yelled at him, and I said, I'm going to give you some life-saving advice. Don't you never tell a woman's age. But 69, you know, is another challenge to reinvent myself once more and to recreate what that means. I do think that women particularly allow ourselves to be defined in ways that ageism does do us in, and it makes us feel less than. And I do believe that from the cradle, we are programmed to feel second class. And, you know, I have one more year, and maybe one more year to fight that, to change that, to reinvent that, to redefine that. Because, hey, you know, we're not dead yet. And we've got this glorious women's group at Glide that, you know, I just rejoice every week when we meet and I see these flames of words just coming out of their mouths, and they're creating poetry out of misery and out of joy and out of, you know, creating self over and over and over again. And that is what gives me hope, is that I know that as long as we're alive and as long as we're connected, that we can create and recreate ourselves every day and change ourselves every day to be more vital, to be more loving, and to be more dynamic for the world, to change the world. Thank you for listening, and thank you for having me.
Our thanks to Janice Mirigatani for her incredibly moving presentation this evening. We knew it would be moving, but take us away. I am Karen Kiefer, a program coordinator in the Commonwealth Club and your chair for this evening. At this time, we'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to And Yet We Are Not Broken, The Journey of Recovery with Janice Mirigatani. At this time, we'll take questions at the microphone in the aisle for people who would like to stand up behind there and ask their questions. I have the first one to ask. As you said, a lot of us have grown up feeling unloved and unlovable. I like the song, We Are the World, We Are Its Children, and each of us has our own story. How and when did you feel the beginnings of the radical love outside of your grandmother? Because a lot of our grandparents were the ones who saved us. But when and how did you feel that spark?
Can I take this off?
Yes, you may.
You know, I didn't have a chance to talk about the 60s because that was a really defining time for me. I think for a lot of us, and particularly around the crises of Dr. King being assassinated, and the war, and, you know, the feminist movement, the onset of the feminist movement, ethics studies strikes, a lot of revolutions that converged, and, you know, like the white water, that all these streams coming together and creating the rapids. And it was during that time when I think a lot of us discovered our voices. And I think we hit our social, economic, and political bottoms, if you know what I mean. And we just had no choice but get into recovery about needing being approval junkies and wanting to be white and middle class and all of that. And I think it did cause us to dare to find our voices and dare to rebel and to say, this is who we are. We're not in the history books. This is not true about us. You know, I mean, we fight the stereotypes. And am I getting too passionate? To fight the stereotypes, to correct all that crap that they had put out about us, you know, the docile exotic Asian women, and, you know, this stuff around African American women, and, you know, we started a coalition of women of color because I started in on writing anthologies. I mean, they allowed me to do this at Glide. I mean, it was great. It was part of the work. It was like a discovery of each other in our different communities. And so African Americans and Latin Americans and, you know, Cubans and Puerto Ricans and Chinese and Filipinos, all ethnic groups came together, and particularly the women. We told our stories to each other, and guess what? They were all the same stories. We thought white men and dating white men, I have nothing against white men, guys, okay? So please don't take anything personally, but we thought this society said to us that white men were the ones who were going to give us our validity as well as our validation as well as our visibility. So we, you know, like we turn against brothers. We said, okay, if we have a chance to date a white guy, even if, you know, he's not as fine as a brother, we'll go with a white guy. And we would laugh and laugh about that because it really did demonstrate to us how we had been so, in our own minds, devalued. And we began to talk about our beauty. We began to talk about the beauty of our color and our culture and our food and our ancestors and our history and how common those threads were of our history, particularly of the oppression and overcoming. And it was glorious. So the radical love started, I think, then, and with the civil rights movement, too.
I'm always curious
to
know.
No, Mr. Kinsella, he is the director of the Art Commission.
Thank you. Janice, I'm always fascinated to hear artists talk about what, you know, where in their lives they connected with that form of expression that really defines them as artists. So in your case, when and how and what were the circumstances when you discovered that poetry and the word would be your dynamic spark?
Thank you for asking. I think it was when I was 8 years old and I was in the throes of the abuse. And I found that the only place that would believe me was the page. So the words, you know, which I created for my own reality, became my life source. My grandmother, by the way, spoke only Japanese. I spoke no Japanese. But we did have a connection. It was that tail thing. But it was my creating my reality on the page that, and I could escape. You know, I think that we find ways to survive. And the way I escape was through reading and through writing and creating my own world. When my poetry, I was a pre-med, as all good Japanese Americans are, until I almost flunked Chem 1A. Oh, God. But, I mean, I was also rebelling, and I said, you know, I'm going to start dating philosophy majors instead of pre-meds and pre-laws. I killed my mother about 30 times when I was going to college because she would call guys. I mean, I'm diverting, but she would call guys. You know, they would call me for a date, and she would call these guys and say, you can come over at 5, but she has an appointment at 8. And then she would set up these dates for me with pre-meds. I mean, she would interview them. Are you pre-med? Are you going to USC? Do you go to UCLA? If you go to City College, you're disqualified. I mean, and she would go the racial thing, you know, if you're Filipino, sorry, she's not going to see you. If you're Chinese, I mean, so where was I? I was saying, the word is where I escaped, that my form of survival. But I think, again, it was the revolution of the 60s where we discovered our own voice, where we discovered the authenticity of who we were. And the word has always been, poetry has always been my choice, the natural way that it feels that I should express who I am and what I see. And I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah. And I think, you know, in first and third persons, it's very interesting. I'll tell you about that later. Yes.
Hi, Janice. First of all, I'm glad that Reverend William said something yesterday at Glide, because I wouldn't have known about your speaking here tonight. And I love to hear you talk when you
Thank
do
you.
Share at Glide. It's always witty, it's always smart, it's funny, it's interesting, and I get a lot out of it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I moved to the city 12 years ago, and I ended up very much, you know, going with the wrong path, and I ended up on drugs and homeless in the Tenderloin. And I remember going to Glide to eat. I didn't know nothing about no church. I went there to eat, and they gave you bagels and coffee in the morning. a year later, I got into a rehabilitation center, and I was having a real hard time with the God concept. I walked into Glide because everybody from rehab went there, and I heard you say something about everyone being welcome, about lesbians. And I got my life together. Mm-hmm. And for that, I hold the two of you personally responsible for my salvation. 2 years ago, you baptized my child, which is my greatest accomplishment to date. I'm wondering, what do you consider your greatest accomplishment to date? I said I wasn't going to do that either.
Your story. I think that every time I hear a poem, I hear somebody's recovery story, every time I hear someone who has been, you know, still alive from the AIDS crisis, every time I, you know, see a young person graduate, you know, when they were destined for some other kind of life, it's my greatest accomplishment. I mean, I take personal credit for it. Actually, you know, I don't, but you know what I mean. It's what keeps me alive. It's what keeps me going. It's what keeps me excited and inspired about what we do. It's what keeps my passion. I can't believe that you're not asking.
Well, I'm going to ask another question, one that I've been struggling with for a while. In fact, I approached one of the ministers at Glide about the question, how do you respond to intolerant people? The motivating slogans in my life are evil prevails when good people do nothing. And if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. I'm a person of love, and it just makes me want to barf when I hear people say something mean. And I don't know how to respond. One of the ministers, Karen, said that you could say, well, how do you think Jesus would feel about this? But a lot of people aren't Christian or religious. So you've had to deal with a lot of intolerant people now, even. How do you do it with love? Or do you?
I'm not sure I do it with love. It's really hard. It's really hard to do. I said at the Youth Speaks event that I quoted Ram Dass, who said that, you know, when you get into a cage with a snake, don't expect to act not like a snake. And when you know that somebody is a snake, you don't go in expecting it to act like a lamb. But then you do understand that you have to hold that snake in a certain way so that you don't get bitten by it. And if you get bitten by it, then, you know, you've set yourself up. But hopefully you learn from that. And I've been bitten a lot of times, and I expect different behavior from people just because they're supposed to do that. But then you find out they're a snake, and I don't mean snake. I'm a snake person in the Chinese calendar, so I don't mean that as a bad thing. But if you know it's a snake, you treat it as a snake, and you keep your distance, you hold it a certain way, and you accept it for what it is. And that's the issue. I think one of the greatest lessons that Cecil gave me is that when you are standing across the tracks, the railroad tracks, and you see a white person who's gnashing their teeth at you, and you know that if you were to cross that railroad track, that that person is going to really try to do something violent to you, and you stand your ground and you accept that person for who he is and who, and you say, I see you, I accept you, you are human, and I am human. And you're not trying to deny that person's hatred or who that person is. What you do is you accept them for who they are. I mean, we had Nazi people who were neo-Nazis who had swastikas on their foreheads who came to Glide, sat in the front pew. And Cecil did not kick them out. We did not kick them out. We did not revile them. We did not get brutal. We did not get violent. We did not, you know, tell them they couldn't come back. And by the third visit, they had removed those signs from their foreheads. And they became some of our most loyal members. It was amazing. I mean, the power of love, I think, is pretty amazing. But I don't respond with love all the time. I can't say that truthfully. I want to stomp my feet and gnash my teeth. And I do. I mean, ask him. But I think you do the best you can at the moment.
Yeah, that was a very thought-provoking, moving presentation. Frankly, I just came here because I had some time to kill and wanted to get out of the rain.
Are you a member of the club?
I'm very glad I did. And the question I have is, yes, you can talk about love, spirituality, etc. But unfortunately, there are evil people in this world. There are bullies that people do us in. As you said, physically as well as emotionally, financially, etc. And I know it's, they say, to turn the other cheek and just accept it. But there's a time when one has to confront this. And so what do you do when you are in a situation when you have these type of bullies and evil people?
You know, I think that it's a complex question, and there's no easy answer to anything. But I think what radical love means to me is that it means that you have to take action. And radical love means to me that you radically love enough to march, you radically love enough to go out and vote, you radically love enough to go and, you know, write to your congressperson, that you radically love enough to say, no, I'm not going to let you, you know, exclude people from this block. I'm going to demonstrate against you. No, you can't. I mean, you know, I thought it was hilarious that Fred Phelps had demonstrated against somebody and they counter-demonstrated by saying, you know, one guy stood on one side of him and another guy stood on the other side of him and one guy said he's and the other guy said gay. And Fred Phelps was in the middle. And it was pretty funny. I mean, it was a very loving way to counter, you know, and to let their presence be known. I think radical love, I think love means that you have to let your presence be known. And it should be to protest, to object, to fight, to battle, to stand up, as much as it is to accept, to embrace, and, you know, all of that. I don't think that we're about mushy, sentimental, you know, yeah, you have to love everybody. I mean, I know that people depict Jesus Christ like that. I don't think so. I think Jesus Christ was a real, you know, tough person. I think that he had fiber. I think he had guts. I think he had a core, and I think he knew what he wanted. And he said, you know, I'm going to drive out the money changers. I'm going to do this. I mean, he took some action, right? Now, whether you believe in Jesus Christ as Lord or whatever, I'm not going there. I'm just saying that the lessons that I learned from Scripture is that. And I think that that's what that models for me.
So you talked about the threads that press present and past, and I wonder what threads you're laying for the future of Glide. And I know that you've already created a great foundation, but I wonder what your main objective as you go through transition and how you see that happening in the future at Glide.
Well, I hope to continue to be of use at Glide, and I think that one of the things that, and I speak for myself, Cecil, that I would like to be useful in doing is to continue making those opportunities or helping to make those opportunities for communities to continue to connect and to bind and to see each other and to recover and to love one another and to build and create together. I don't know what that means. There are some concrete projects. There are some exciting partnerships. I think that young people who are now, you know, getting involved and who are being vocal are just so exciting, and I'm looking forward to the partnerships with new partnerships with Youth Speaks, for example, with, you know, different groups that come in with maybe the Art Corridor, Luis, that, you know, street people will have a place that they can come in and make expression and talk about who they are, tell their stories, that they have a space to do that. I'm hoping that we can create a way in which people can connect to legacy. I don't want, you know, in 5 years for people to forget what Cecil has done for 45. I'm hoping that Glide can be a model, a national model, an international model. You know, people come from all over the world to visit us, and they want to know if there's a Glide existing in Switzerland or in Sweden or Santa Cruz. And I think that GLIDE can be a model. We have many programs that can be replicated, I think. Not in our way, but in their way. But I think beloved communities are what are needed now more than ever.
Unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where we have time for one last question. Pete?
Pete.
Hi, Jan.
Hi, Pete.
What a story. Thank you. I was so moved by
thank you.
By what you said about the programming that you internalized when you were young, feeling less than. And I was looking around this room, this incredibly diverse room full of people, and just feeling that the messages that each of us maybe internalized when we were young that made us feel less than, that made us feel like we need to compensate in some way for an ideal. To the kids, I know you talked about working with children, to parents, to people who work with children, what are some of the thoughts that you have about how we can give the best messages to the young people of today so that that programming of being less than, maybe we can start to turn that.
Well, I think we're doing it. I think you're doing it. I think everybody here who is part of the programs and everybody in the congregation who cheers our children on when they sing, when they make mistakes, when they get up, that they're cheered. And they're given a mirror of affirmation all the time. I think the mentoring, I think letting every child know that they belong to a family that cares about them beyond their own parents. And I think the programming that we're doing for parenting, teaching parents about, you know, being better parents, teaching parents about nutrition, you know, creating now healthy ways in which we approach children, and that in ways in which we prepare children for school or for their future is really critical, and it really does. I mean, I hate to be trite, but it really does take a village, and it really does take the counseling, the mental health, it takes the peer groups, it takes all the wonderful teachers we have at GLIDE, and it takes you, the community, to, you know, let them know that you carry them, that you're there, your tails are connected. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Charles.
Our thanks this evening to Janice Mirigatani for her moving presentation that can help so many of us find our voice. We also thank our audiences here as well as our radio audience. This evening's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Literature Series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.